This is the Goggler Podcast. Uma, Ian, and Bahe with you, stuck at home for like the fourth week now. We're slowly beginning to lose track of time and space. Welcome to yet another quarantine edition. This week we're going to be talking about the Malaysian political thriller Daulat, the first ever Malaysian political thriller. We're going to be talking about Amazon Prime's Tales from the Loop, as well as HBO's Run, besides all of the regular news and quick bits that we cover.
I'm also going to jump in there with a quick bit on Netflix, a Korean drama called Vagabond, which I want to
Wait. Ian McNally, have you gotten yourself into Korean drama?
Not quite, but we'll talk about it later.
All right. But first, how has it been? Week four, under quarantine, isolation, what's going on?
Same shit, different day.
Sourdough starter is coming along rather well.
Sure.
It's on day number four.
Of course you're making a sourdough starter.
I figure, why not, man? Now we've got the time to like tend to it and take care of it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in the same boat. I bought two loaves of bread yesterday.
Animal Crossing is still incredibly addictive. It's, you know, my one chance to see the outdoors.
How's the eggs treating you? Because I've heard they can be a bit annoying.
Actually, surprisingly not. But then again, I think it's because it's not very hard to get all of these recipes. So for those of you who are not playing Animal Crossing, because it's Easter, every time there's a special occasion, they have special events in the game as well. And there is a rabbit character that shows up and tries to get you to collect eggs and make Easter-themed things throughout the week.
Well, it's not Easter, is it? It's Happy Egg Day.
Happy Bunny Day, Egg Day, whatever. You can't call it Easter because it's secular, right? Whatever.
No, every week, like, I just hear the bits and pieces from the podcast and super here for your background. Like, so I heard everything about the tarantulas before Uma found the tarantulas.
Yeah.
Now with the eggs, all I see online are people complaining because they want to build roads or they need to get resources for things. And so instead of finding iron or wood, all they're finding is fucking eggs.
Yeah. So it's like when you hit a tree, you usually get wood to get resources. Now you end up getting eggs. So after Easter, everything should return to normal, hopefully. Like when you go fishing, instead of pulling up a fish, you pull up a fucking egg all the time now. But it's fine. It's still a fun game. I've been holding off buying Final Fantasy VII Remake because I'm behaving myself. Even though
for now,
I've heard very, very good things, and it's one of the first games I played on my PS, like, 30 years ago, 25 years ago.
I mean, apparently it's value for money because it's like, I've heard people say it takes like, you can play it for at least 30 hours.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
And there's also like side content to do as well. So
yeah. You're not helping my self-control here.
Yeah. I think I have on every storefront, like Steam, Switch, everything. I think I have the original, like there's a remastered version or just the original version. I have them wishlisted on everything because we had a dodgy PlayStation and a dodgy PC back in the day where I think the save card would get corrupted on the PlayStation when we were playing Final Fantasy, and the PC would blue screen ever so often and I'd lose all my progress in the first Deus Ex game.
Ugh.
So we played the beginning of those games a lot.
I've never played a single Final Fantasy game.
Yeah, 7's the only one I've dipped in my toe in. And even in the mid-2000s, it was kind of annoying because, like, you know, it's not like watching a black and white film. The actual mechanics and everything else can be a bit annoying.
Right.
To those of us used to, you know, wide open spaces and free roaming and Red Dead Online kind of stuff.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Remember what that was like? Out in the real world? Yeah. So what else have you guys been up to? I mean, the other thing we've been trying to look at over here in my house is long series, television series that have gone on for many, many years that we can now either revisit or catch up on. So something that's gone on for 10 seasons, 11 seasons, The Office, Modern Family, stuff like that, you know? And because, like you said, Ian, it gives you something, I guess, familiar to dip into every day, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've been doing Community, actually, in this house. So we're on season 3 now.
Jeez, already? Yeah, it was only up last week.
That's been fun. It's been fun.
You're 60 episodes in already.
Remember how good that writing was.
So yeah, we're still stuck at home for the foreseeable future, it seems. At the time of this recording, our self-isolation was supposed to end on April 14th, but it looks like, along with the rest of the world, this might go on for quite a while. Given that, we've still been looking at everything that's been going on, not just in Hollywood, but also in the UK, in our own movie industry. And we're going to be talking about one of those things with the way Dawlat was released a little later. But it seems like everyone is slowing down. I mean, Disney announced a series of furloughs with their staff that's coming up, and especially with regards to their distribution, global distribution, because obviously movies are going to be on hold for quite a while. And, you know, I hope this doesn't actually affect the folks we know over at Disney Malaysia, who are primarily responsible for distribution. But it seems like all the major studios in America are going to be doing this. And yeah, I mean, the fallout is global, right? Everyone gets affected all over the world. The other thing which made the news, of course, this is something we've been talking about over the last few weeks, which is about, I guess, awards eligibility. All the award shows are going to have trouble since there are absolutely no movies. And it's going to be interesting to see whether how many of them actually carry on. But the Screen Actors Guild has come out and said that they're actually going to change award eligibility rules. I think the Oscars has kind of hinted at it. So,
well, if they don't, the Oscar for Best Leading Male goes to Vin Diesel for Bloodshot.
That's right. Long time coming, my friend. Trolls World Tour wins Best Animated Film.
Yeah.
Or that guy who played the Invisible Man in The Invisible Man. And they just show like his clips are just scenes of hallways.
I wonder, yeah, the other thing it would be that, you know, Netflix would essentially take it, wouldn't they?
Well, that's the thing. They wouldn't, because there wouldn't be any qualifying runs.
They're not in the cinemas. Yeah, they can't.
Correct. You still have to have a certain amount of days in cinemas, right?
Yeah. Which, it's one of these things like, you know, not having socialized healthcare, not being able to work from home. It's one of these rules that in lights of things, the way they are now, it's like, well, once they roll it off, it's going to be hard to put it back in place.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah.
And also, I think it becomes more and more ridiculous in this current world, right? Not just in a coronavirus world, but in a insanely digital world.
I mean, all it took was the almost complete destruction of their entire business model for them to change a few things.
Correct. Because in the long run, I mean, there was a news story about AMC cinemas in the US not being able to survive, possibly not being able to survive the shutdown. And I think that goes, I mean the same goes for a lot of cinemas all over the world.
A lot of just businesses in general. It turns out paying your shareholders massive dividends every year and not having a rainy day fund might have been a bit of a problem.
Might have been a bad idea.
Did you guys hear about Wimbledon? So for the past 10 plus years, they've been paying out for a pandemic insurance.
Really?
So their potential payout for this year could be close to $150 million.
So they're the only event in the world that actually had it covered.
They're the only one that read that Time magazine article from 2 years ago and went, wait a minute, we're on to something.
This is something we should get on,
All the people who worked in the US pandemic agency that was shut down, they all moved to Wimbledon. Plus, you know, they've probably got like, what was the coverage you think they said?
I think the payout would be about close to 150, 140 mil.
Yeah, that'll probably only cover the budget that they normally spend on strawberries and cream and champagne.
Yeah,
they've probably got a long-term standing order on that kind of stuff, you know? So
they have to pay out for. Yeah.
Amazon Studios has bought the rights to My Spy, which was that Dave Bautista movie that was supposed to open here about late February, early March, which got delayed because of Corona. I think they're going to be streaming it exclusively on Amazon Prime in the US and some foreign markets. I'm not sure. This one was originally supposed to be distributed by TGV Pictures over here. So I'm not sure if they still hold on to those rights when the cinemas finally reopen again.
Yeah, that's going
to
be tricky how they figure that out.
Yeah, right? But also, this is just, it's another one of those wrestler doing comedy with
comedy
kids
type things. Yeah.
To kind of show range.
The movie looks like Stuber Part 2. Like the Stuber, but with a kid. And that's not appealing at all. But it's just interesting to see another film go straight to streaming. Like, I mean, with this one, they're like, it wasn't going to make any money. Let's see what we can get. I think I saw there was another story about Bob Iger saying that some more movies might go the Artemis Fowl route. It's like, yeah, the movies that we had no confidence in. It's just like, was he just like, New Mutants?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just quick out, right? It's like, eh, you know, why waste money on advertising and AMP and just throw it on Disney Plus and be done with
again,
it.
Again, for like yeah. the fifth time.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, yeah.
I just want to watch New Mutants now. Just put it somewhere, anywhere. That's going to be the tipping point, right? At which point do you start putting out even the movies that you have confidence in on streaming? I think they might lead with some of the talkies first, like the Oscar stuff, the Oscar baity stuff, and then save the Black Widows and those kind of things to like...
The roller coaster rides that you want to see in the big screen.
Yeah, and the surefire post-billion-dollar movies, right? I mean, those things you know are going to break a billion worldwide. So
Wonder Woman.
Yeah, Wonder Woman. You kind of save those for the big screen. But everything else, the Top Guns, the James Bonds... Yeah, and then everything else you might be forced to release on streaming. The only problem with that, as far as I see it, is if you do release it on streaming, if you do a rental model, then you've got to price it accordingly to region and not just keep it as US dollar pricing, because then everywhere else in the world it becomes completely prohibitively expensive.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then you have the problem of trying to police that with regards to geo-locks and things like that. Because it's what? It's 20. I think Birds of Prey, I just saw this morning, has gone from its $20 to rent, or was it to own, to now $5.99 to rent, I think.
Right. So Birds of Prey was a regular release on iTunes. So it wasn't rental only. It wasn't an early release. So that's $19.99 to own. And then I think $5.99 to rent or $4.99 to rent.
Yeah, but it's gone to $4.99 to rent today, I think. I mean, maybe it was only to own, I think, for a week or two.
Normally for the first week or two, it's to own only. But things like The Hunt, those other movies that kind of Paramount released in advance, they're still $20 just to rent.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, I don't know. I don't know. Is that fine if you're in the US? Because I think cinema tickets are that price.
I've heard, and I'm not sure if I've said this before. I think I forget what we do every Friday. I think I've said before, I listened to podcasts where someone's talking about they have young children, they need to get a babysitter, they got a gas for the car if they live far away, you got to get, you know, maybe the popcorn and stuff like that is going to be that price anyway.
Right.
So that's covering some of that for them. I mean, they did this originally with was it Tower Heist, was the Eddie Murphy movie where it was like $40 to rent on opening day or something like that?
Right, yes.
So they experimented with that model before. It's finding that sweet spot. But to come back to what you're saying about those big blockbuster movies, there's a certain point where they had those on their balance sheets as we were going to make this much money for this year and everyone was going to get this much dividend. And to ramp up, go on about this some more, they were also going to do so many share buybacks, which is what all the evil corporations would be doing.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's only so long that they can go without doing that. Where it will, if we're still doing this in November, they're all going to be like, screw it, everything's a Christmas movie.
And also, they're going to have to develop some kind of new platform, logistical distribution system. I don't know. Work out some kind of way to get these movies to people in the most convenient way possible, right? I mean, the Netflixes, the Amazon Primes, the iTunes already have the back end ready to service this sort of thing. But then you're dealing with three separate corporations, all of which are competitors in some ways.
Also, back end service, name of your sex tape.
Yay! Moving on! this piece of news kind of annoyed me, and I think it annoyed you as well, Ian, but Sentient Entertainment apparently has scored the remake rights to Alejandro Amenábar's The Others, you know, that Nicole Kidman movie. And why? That movie was brilliant.
Yeah, a movie that was brilliant, but that I haven't thought about in years. And then I read this story, and I was instantly enraged.
Yeah. No, that movie was genuinely frightening and just great.
And an absolutely fantastic twist. And it just used light and shadow and mist fantastically, right? It was like this misty house and the husband waiting for the husband to come back from war. And it was just creepy as hell.
Yeah. And instead, the plan is to reinvent and modernize the story. No, we don't need to reinvent and modernize that story. It was a great war story. Just rewatch
it. Watch it again. The others.
Well, I just looked up Sentient Entertainment, and they're it's an absolutely random organization. in the sense that they've like on IMDb they've got three movies listed to them, three titles. Mm-hmm. One is a David Cronenberg movie from 2014, Maps to the Stars.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next one is Sombra in 2020, something about a Colombian drug sniffing dog. I'm just like, okay. So it's strange that they've gone out to buy this movie, and especially to remake this movie. Is there any way you would be okay with them remaking it? Because in my head, I'm thinking, maybe if it was a Spanish remake, maybe if it was an Italian remake, maybe I'd be up for that. But
I'd even just because like take the creepiness of it and just expand upon it. It's one of those annoying things where just like why remake when you could like. It's 2000. I didn't realize it was 2001. Like, again, yeah. The brand name recognition is not going to be huge on this.
No.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it wasn't that. I don't think it was that widely seen when it first came out.
I think, it was quite, looking at the news report on this, it was relatively successful at the time. I mean, I think it was before the Saws and all those, but it was, around the time of The Devil's Backbone?
Yes. It
would have been in the kind of spate of like, foreign creepy horror movies that were just doing it better while Hollywood was still doing jump scares and stuff like that.
Mm.
They were doing genuinely creepy, scary visuals. Not scary visuals, but like interesting creepy visuals, like, you know, the way The Ring does the Sadako from the well. I think this had just an awful lot of like weird imagery, and it wasn't Ellen Burstyn, but it was someone like that as the housekeeper who was just creepy. There's a housekeeper and two servants working in the house. And, you know, just watching Nicole Kidman slowly go insane is always good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From that news story, The Others made $200 million at the global box office in 2001.
Whoa, did it really?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. My bad. Okay then, my bad. Yeah.
So it did all right. It
did okay.
It did all right, yeah. It did okay, I guess.
Maybe that's why they want to remake it. Okay, so moving on, we've got the Daily Beast had a really interesting article following up from something we spoke about a few weeks ago, which was about editing out the butthole in Cats. Apparently, it was a thing. There was a butthole.
Apparently, there were several buttholes.
Yeah.
Including director Tom Hooper.
Yeah.
Oh, got there before I did.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really... I don't know what's the word.
Damning? Eye-opening?
Damning. Yeah, it's because I didn't, you know, it's really weird to hear about a director of Tom Hooper's caliber / experience / stature to be that big a pain in the butt.
but also that ignorant when it comes to CG and VFX.
Yes.
Yeah, so did this I didn't get a chance to read this. Did this pull from those Reddit posts that were up a couple of months back?
No, like talking the Daily Beast got to someone who was one of the VFX guys who was brought in to edit out the butthole.
Oh yeah, but no, this one's much worse because apparently Tom Hooper was so unawares of the process behind CG and VFX that he would insist that he got fully rendered scenes to see and not work cuts, even though they took far too long, because apparently if he just received work cuts, he would reply with rude emails going, "What is this garbage?"
To individual people, right? He would reply to individuals, "Your work is not great," as opposed to "This needs to be improved."
Yeah.
I mean, the movie might not be great, but I look forward to the movie about making the movie.
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah, that expose in a couple of years would be great.
And I think the article points out something interesting because, you know, the VFX guys and the CG guys got really upset at the joke they made during the Oscars. And initially, when I read that, I was like, oh, yeah, it's just a joke. Everyone's just having a little bit of fun. And this guy was like, yeah, no, not really, because most of us didn't eat or sleep or we stayed in the offices because it took us 4 months to create 6 months to create a 2-minute trailer, and then we were given 4 months to finish an hour and a half movie. And working conditions were absolute hell.
Yeah, it's about time anyone who works like long-term with a computer and has to do times like that, they need to do the same thing the video game industry does and just unionize. That's the only way they're going to get anything done. It's insane. Because all those people are out of work now probably as well. And not only that, they have cats on their resume, which is like, I curse thee!
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd remove that from my resume. Oh, I didn't do anything for 12 months. No, I just sat at home.
It was 2020.
I'm only halfway through it, so it'll be my recommendation anyway because it's pretty good. But the video essayist Lindsay Ellis has a video up, which is called "Why Is Cats?"
Oh, I saw this. Yeah.
So it's a combination of it's about the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, but also the movie. I'm halfway through where she's getting to the movie part. So, but it's very funny, and I'm enjoying it a lot. And just like there's some fantastic interviews over the years of like Andrew Lloyd Webber telling potential directors or production assistants that like it's just about cats. Like to questions like, is it about like capitalism or is it about the working man or is it about all this? No. Just about cats.
Tom Hooper must have heard those interviews because he was asking the VFX guys to just bring cats in to do the movements and the dance sequences.
Yeah. Like actual cats.
Tom Hooper was just like, why don't you just bring in cats to do the thing and shoot it and then you can animate it? And the VFX guys just went, but cats don't dance. Yeah,
well, you know what they say? Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
It really is. Yeah. No, go check out the article. We'll put a link to it up on the podcast page, but it's in the Daily Beast. And I think it's just one of those things that gives you real insight into sometimes, you know, you think watching the movie was hell, making it seemed much, much worse. And you remember all that hoopla after Life of Pi, right? With VFX artists doing great work and then they losing all their jobs and companies shutting down. And it feels like they still seem to be at the lowest end of the totem pole. But also, given that so many of these movies rely on that to even exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was... Did you see the footage? I saw a tweet that was about Mamma Mia 2. Here I go again.
Yeah. What about Mamma Mia 2?
And it was all the CG that was in the background of the shots. Like, they have they do the wipe where you see them in front of a green screen and then they're in Greece.
Yeah.
And like, just everything. Even... Colin Firth when he's in the hotel in Tokyo, like everything outside the window is green screen. That whole movie was shot on sets. They didn't go outside at all.
Really?
By the looks of things. Yeah. I'll see if I can find the tweet and put it in the show notes. But it was like, it just showed even when you don't think there's effects.
Right.
There's so many of these companies trying to do this kind of thing and they're all reinventing the wheel every time they do it, but they're all competing against each other, which is exactly how the studios and everyone wants it. So they all got a band to form some kind of league that could fight for justice for themselves.
The big one for me was a couple of years ago. There was a footage, I can't remember the name of the company, but they released their showreel and, you know, things like Ugly Betty was shot on a set, you know, just TV shows. They don't even go
and
out
like
anymore.
Not in an office, right? You thought they would actually be in an office.
Yeah. So
later seasons of Sex and the City or something? I remember something where they shot outside, but they had to block off the end of the street because of traffic and onlookers. So these have a big green screen and they put the rest of the street in.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I mean, that green screen tech is just, it's so integral to filmmaking nowadays that you can't go through an episode of a silly, you know, sitcom like Ugly Betty without having to use green screen technology.
Which makes it all the crazier when you're watching a big like slugfest like CGI thing, and the lighting doesn't match and the people look rubbery. It's like you created all of Tokyo for this one shot out a window. Yeah, people are really hard. I guess that's the Uncanny Valley. It's like it's easier to spot weirdness of people.
Yeah.
We've got some trailers to talk about. Nothing in the cinemas, obviously, but some good stuff coming your way on streaming. Afterlife Season 2, which will be dropping on Netflix April 24th. Did you guys catch Season 1 at all?
Yeah, I did. It's not funny, and I don't think it's meant to be, but at the same time...
Because
it's just...
the concept is kind of gloomy, right?
He's a gloomy
dealing
show
with the death of his wife.
Yeah, but it's also it's angry Ricky Gervais.
But that's usually good.
I don't know.
Put me off the first season, and this second season looks like something I'd actually be interested in. This looks a bit more less assholey or assholey with a nicer intention because it mean spirited was the first one seemed mean spirited.
The first one was mean spirited. It was essentially Ricky Gervais being an asshole the entire time to people who are trying to help him. And there's you know, there's a way to approach that as sweet, as humbling, as comedic, but he just approaches it as mean-spirited, and it was not a... it wasn't an easy watch. It's not that it's the death thing. It's the, God, I really hate Ricky Gervais. Yeah, and that was the problem.
I think I've said before, like, Extras was the pinnacle for me because I could relate. I could not relate, but, like, he seemed understandable and likable in that. I can't watch The Office because I'll collapse down to a super dense mass of cringe. I just can't handle that show. And all the things he's done. I mean, I used to see, what was it called? The 11 o'clock show? There was something with Ian Lee. It used to be a show on Channel 4. And they would have Ricky Gervais on doing news stories. And he was David Brent, the character at that point. You know what I mean? Before David Brent. And it was just like, who is this unlikable slime ball? And it was an act, but he was really good at it. To the point that I thought he was an unlikable slime ball. And it took a long time to get over that. And then I'm like, I'm okay with not watching stuff he does these days.
Yeah.
But this trailer looked more interesting to me than the first one.
Well, that drops April 24th, and we will definitely check it out.
April 24th? This is the first trailer for this, and it's coming out April 24th?
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
But you know what Netflix is like? It's very rare that they release a trailer and then say coming next year, right? Normally it's some normally it's like some ridiculous teaser like with Stranger Things where you just show absolutely nothing and then just go 3 or 4.
Yeah. I'm just looking for a pile of papers I can throw in the air because there goes the schedule for the month.
We've also got The Great coming to Hulu, which is about Catherine the Great, only it's a different approach to the HBO series with Helen Mirren. This one shows a young prequel. Catherine. Yes, it's a prequel with Ellie Fanning and Nicholas Holt. It's also a more comedic take on the whole thing.
Mm. Yeah.
It looks like Catherine the Great meets Miracle Workers.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Remember Miracle Workers, that show we reviewed 3 years ago in February?
No, but did you guys see the HBO series? Because the HBO series was interesting.
Yes, I did.
Right?
It was slow.
It was slow.
Interesting because I didn't think it was great, but she was fantastic. So I kept watching because she was so good.
Yeah, we kept watching because we said we'd do something on it.
I think that was why we watched it, I don't think I finished it. I think I must have seen a couple episodes. Unless it was only a couple episodes, then I don't know anymore.
I think we didn't get the last episode, I think, of the previews when we did it. Yeah. So, but I wasn't looking for it, you know. It was just like, No, actually we did. We got the whole, it was only a miniseries, only 3 or 4 episodes. It does kind of end, and you're like, it ended. I guess that was a thing I watched. Like, it was only last year, and I can't remember anything.
I can't remember anything about it, yeah.
Apart from a band playing on a boat in the wintertime when it's freezing and their fingers are cold. Because these royals don't give a shit. That's how they roll.
Yeah. Watching this trailer, it kind of reminded me a little bit of Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette from 2006 with Kirsten Dunst, where it has this modern take on a period drama where everyone kind of speaks like modern individuals and the music's kind of modern, but...
But this is more fun. This feels like an actual comedy.
Yes.
You know? It feels like a satirical comedy. It feels like something Amando Iannucci would do. You know, that fast-paced, that little joke, that very jokey thing.
Yeah, there's a nice moment where Nicholas Holt is toasting his new wife and she stands up to say something. Says, no, you don't talk because that's the time that is. And she's like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hulu seems to be rolling out a whole bunch of originals on a relatively regular basis these days. So I haven't seen Little Fires Everywhere, which is the new Reese Witherspoon one, which is getting some really, really good reviews as well.
Yeah.
I heard it went off the boil near the end, though, did it?
I haven't seen any of it.
The reviews started strong, and then I heard kind of like, I mean, it's no Big Little Lies, apparently.
Ah, okay. Because it's Kerry Washington and Reese Witherspoon. So, and both of them are fantastic normally. So, yeah, I mean, I was going to go check it out. I haven't read the book either. It's based on a really popular book, too. But no, this one looks like something I would sit down and kind of consume. The Great with Ellie Fanning and Nicholas Holt. So that's dropping on Hulu. You'll find a way to watch it, I'm sure, even if you don't have Hulu. Going on to some news, some quick bits to cover. Ian, just what? Vagabond? Korean drama? What's going on? When? How?
All right. Hear me out, guys.
Okay.
Wait. I've got nothing against Korean dramas, right? Yeah. I mean, but I didn't think you were into them.
My girlfriend's been working through them, so I think Crash Landing on You is one that we should probably cover because it's up and down in the top 10 of Netflix in Malaysia all the time. And Davina's finished that one, so she's on to other series. And she saw one that thought might catch my eye. This is Korean 24.
What?
No.
So there's a... It's also as confusing as that sounds. There's this opening scene that hasn't been referenced since... we're on episode 11, I think, of 16. There's an opening scene that sets up one thing that has not been referenced since. And I presume that's the present day that we're going to get to. But it's a very different like setup completely from what we're watching. The actual setup is that there's a Korean stuntman guy and his nephew is on this flight to represent Korea Taekwondo in Morocco at a celebration to basically celebrate their 60 years or something like that of diplomatic communications. And the plane unfortunately goes down, but there's, you know, foul play is afoot. And it's like, this is like the plane crash in Lost.
Okay.
This is the level of polish and sheen we're looking at. Like, this, if you have any fear of flying or have any, you know, any kind of relations with anyone who's been in an accident, do not watch this because it is incredibly well done. But as it goes on, when he's going to the kind of memorial service they're having in Morocco, the last video his nephew uploaded to their cloud drive before the plane took off, there's a guy in the background. He sees that guy.
Oh.
So the fact that he's a stuntman means that when he gets into the fight and the other guy is obviously a combat trained operator, he can hold his own because he's a stuntman who knows like multiple layers of martial arts, stunt driving and weapons and stuff like that.
Nice.
And he's called Cha Dalgyeon, who's played by Seonggi Lee, and he's paired up with this actress Suzy Bae, who plays Go-Haeri, who she's part of the NIS, which up until I saw Hitman Jun a while ago, didn't realize is the 24 parallels are there. It's the CTU. Right. I mean, they are the National Intelligence Service, I think it is. And as the episodes go along, he's an annoyance at first, and they do have some of that Asian, we'll just say it's Korean drama, or just like melodrama things, where he tends to shout a lot for the first couple of episodes, even at people who are helping him, and in a really annoying way. She does some of that stereotypical drama acting as well, where it's like, well, why are you talking like that? You know, why don't you think I'm up to the job kind of thing?
Right.
It kind of be grating, but I think it must be in his contract for the first five episodes. He has to have an amazing foot chase. And they obviously put a lot of money into this because they do shoot in Morocco. So you have parkour going across rooftops of like, you know, the small villages in Morocco that look a little bit like the favelas in Brazil, if you've seen Fast and Furious, running across the rooftops of that, chasing people down, getting into like their extended chases where they get into the cars, all this kind of stuff. You get more and more agents coming in. You know, you're not sure who's corrupt, who's on your side. People switch back and forth. There's one guy who's number one wanted in the country for one episode. And then by the next episode, he's back in with the NIS and he's leading teams again. You don't know who to trust.
Oh, there goes my weekend.
It's really, really good. So we're only on episode 11. We'll see. I don't know if it's going to be a multiple series thing or not. Again, I only realized sitting here to think about it. Like, hang on, that first scene, we are nowhere near what that first scene implies. Again, there's also like the tone is wobbling a bit. Like some of the moments of pathos and emotion with regards to ever so often, like he's hanging out with some of the other bereaved who had victims on the flight. And they're really hard to watch. Like not because they're bad, but because of the emotion is so strong and the acting is so good.
Right.
Then there's like really stupid, goofy humor at certain points. And then there's just like an all out battle, like gunfire battle that looks like something out of Call of Duty, like that, like really, really good, not in a bad way. And it's incredibly fun to watch. And the episode's about 1 hour long, and the screen drama seems to be quite long.
So it's in progress at the moment. It's not something that's done.
It was out in Korea in September 2019. So
So it's recent.
It's a Netflix original. So, you know, I'm sorry, air quotes for those of you listening at home.
Yeah.
So I think it was on TV in September 2019 in Korea, so it's on there now. I just hadn't heard of it before. It was highlighted by my girlfriend, as I said, and we're really enjoying it.
Cool. Vagabond, cool. Which is on Netflix.
And I should say as well, there's also some other fun moments. If you are playing along at home, play the game where see if you can count how many times they reference a well-known sandwich maker that was also in Happy Gilmore. I don't want to give them free advertising on here, but you know the one I'm talking about, right?
Nice. Okay. Yeah.
It's bizarre how often it turns up.
Sponsored by Eat Fresh.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Speaking of quick bits, this week also saw the launch to very, very little fanfare of Jeffrey Katzenberg's $2 billion investment, Quibi, which is the quick bits made into a thing, which is supposed to be a mobile-only platform, a streaming platform that produces and presents content that is under 10 minutes. And whether it's a movie, a TV series, whatever, you watch it part by part every weekday in segments that are between 6 and 8 minutes long. It is an interesting concept, which I was rather apprehensive about until I tried it out, and it's actually quite fascinating. I think it's quite good.
Do you remember that Media Prima tried something similar years ago?
They did, like these short bites of content, right?
But the problem was that they weren't creating content for that time format. They were just chopping up their TV shows into these 6-10 minute bits, which is stupid because then I'll have to wait till the next time the episode comes out to know what happens from that 6 minutes. And I think the way you've described it, Uma, is that this feels more contained, which I think is the way it should be, which is the way it should go, I think.
So some things obviously work better than others for this format, but I think it feels like the creators are still trying to find their feet. So they've rebooted MTV's Punk'd, for example, with Chance the Rapper, right? And that's perfect for this. Everyone just kind of gets pranked in 5 or 6 minutes. You laugh at stupid celebrities and then you move on. That kind of works. They've got a Funny or Die series with Will Forte and Caitlin Olsen from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And they play this couple, this really obnoxious couple that want to get into the home improvement TV business. So they want to be one of those couples that goes and redoes your house. And they want to submit an audition tape. So they kind of buy this house out in the middle of fucking nowhere to try and film their audition tape. And they find buried in the walls $500,000 of mob money. And they don't know what it is. And they kind of use it. And then the mob shows up. The Mexican mafia shows up, right? It's drug money. That is really well done. Like, you can tell it's Funny or Die because they clearly have the experience of crafting short content. So every episode has so much story and laughs crammed into that 6-7 minutes. It's astounding. Like, that's really good.
It's updated every day, every weekday, is it?
Every weekday you get a new episode.
Yeah. Of the same show?
Of the same show. So, like, you know, which is weird from a storytelling perspective because it feels like then everything has to end on a cliffhanger to keep you excited and interested to come back for the next episode, right?
That was my first thought. Does that show end on like a cliffhanger or a question mark every time?
Sometimes. So there are 6 episodes out of Flipped. That's what the show is called. And yes, some end on funny moments, some end on cliffhangers. But for the most part, that actually feels like 7 minutes that's been structured as a 3-act episode, right? And it's done very well. Then there are the movies. This is where it gets a little tricky. So there's Survive with Sophie Turner and Most Dangerous Game with Liam Hemsworth and Christoph Waltz. And Survive, Sophie Turner plays a suicidal woman who decides she wants to end her life. She's left the rehab center and she wants to end her life on the airplane while she flies home for Christmas. But the airplane crashes and she is one of 2 survivors, the other one played by Corey Hawkins, and they both have to fight to survive.
They have to survive on an island or something, is it?
No, they crash on a mountaintop, like a snow-covered mountain.
Oh, okay, because when I heard the synopsis first, I thought this was like Jeff Bridges and Fearless.
Ah, yeah, no. Man, that movie was good.
So it's Fearless meets Alive.
Kind of, only it's not as, I would say, action-packed as those. I mean, it doesn't move like those movies did, right? Survive feels like someone took a movie and then snipped it up into its component parts. Most Dangerous Game, on the other hand, with Liam Hemsworth, he plays a guy who's dying of cancer, has no money, meets Christoph Waltz, and Christoph Waltz in the first episode says, here's an offer, I'll give you millions of dollars, but you will be hunted through the streets of Chicago.
Which is Hard Target and what's the other one called?
Yes, not Running Man.
Deadliest Game.
Deadliest Game. Correct.
Yeah. Our target's the one with Jean-Claude Van Damme. This game is the one with Ice Cube, Ice T.
One of
these
the
VHS
ices.
Classics.
Yeah.
These are the human. Wow. I'm a big fan of the humans hunting humans genre.
Correct. The hunting humans, right?
But oh, yeah.
You must be really looking forward to the hunt then.
Because I think it's structured more tightly. And so as the chase begins, you really want to find out more of what happens. But also, I think it kind of proves that Liam Hemsworth is a great leading man in that since the movie or series or whatever you want to call it is centered around him, he's really, really watchable.
Are those actually movies? They're just series as well. They're going to run for quite a long time, right? They're not going to just run for 3 weeks and then be finished.
I don't know, because when I was reading about Survive and Most Dangerous Game, they sound like they're movies. Or they sound like they were features as opposed to Flipped, which feels more traditional sitcom.
Series.
Yeah. Mm. So I'm not sure what everything is. But then there's reality TV as well. And with reality TV, what they do is sometimes they split up one episode into three parts and then it's 18 minutes and that makes sense. Sometimes they try to like cram everything, like this show called Dishmantled, which is so American. Basically, two chefs stand in a tube covered in hazmat suits. Food is blown at them, exploded at them. They don't know what it is. They gotta like lick things and taste the walls and stuff. And then they gotta go create that food again, which seems tonally discordant given the world we're living in now where people have trouble accessing food sometimes. But it's hosted by Titus Burgess, who is hilarious and funny and great. But, you know, you like the cooking shows too. You know, the drama and fake tension and all of the fighting and inner conflict. You can't do that in 7 minutes. And so that's not there. The coolest thing about Quibi is the app. It just like the transition between like, because obviously it's only on your phone. You can't cast it to your TV. You can't watch it. Oh, you can watch it on your iPad, but it's just an iPhone app that's kind of expanded. So
stretched.
Yeah, not great. But they know that some people like watching things in portrait mode. Silly people. But, you know, when you rotate the phone, the video actually seamlessly rotates and kind of is edited and created to actually work on both ways as best as possible.
Yeah, I'd heard that actually their editing pipeline has to, they output it twice.
Oh, it's nuts, dude. Because obviously in podcast. A game, in a reality show, when, you know, when they do side-by-side stuff, it becomes top and down on the on the vertical view. But it's so fast.
Wow.
Like, it's there's no lag. There's no pause. I've been, like, moving my phone around like crazy, and it doesn't get old. It's kind of funky.
Yeah, that for me is the one that I really am curious about, because I think when they first announced it, it was only supposed to be in portrait mode. But then just before release, I think they bought over a company that has that tech. So then they announced that you could also do it in landscape. Yeah. So I think that to me is very interesting, because how do you, as a guy who's been on set, as a guy who's managed and run sets, you wonder how they focus. Where's the camera's focus at that point? If you're thinking about, you know, because if it's portrait, then you obviously want to show length and you want to show height. But then at the same time, if you just swap it over, do you do that zoom and scan?
It feels like everyone is still shooting traditionally, except maybe for the reality shows. So for the films and the TV shows, it feels like a landscape view is still their primary perspective. And then they kind of snip it down so it focuses on the most relevant bits.
Cropped it.
So when you rotate, you don't get the corner of someone's hand, for example.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the, have you checked back in? Like, was it launched what day? Was it Monday?
Monday.
Yeah. So have you checked in? Like, if you skip a show for a few days, do they just all queue up and play? What's the experience for that?
Oh, yeah. So if I skip the show for a couple of days. So then when you go back, you can follow people like in social media, and the show comes up on your feed and you click play. It'll show you the last episode you watched first, as in the last new episode. And then it'll just continue. So the interesting thing about Quibi as well is, because it's a mobile-only thing, they've announced that they're going to be using all of the technology in your phone. So your cameras and all of that stuff. So apparently they're going to do like a dating show where you can have interaction with people watching. Steven Spielberg's releasing a horror series, which will only play at night, depending where you are, to add the fear factor. So apparently they're doing all of these cute things. It's not the place you go to do a House of Cards. Yeah. If you're a creator. But I think it still allows for some pretty interesting content on there. So Yeah, it's just nice to see something different. It's like,
we'll see if it's a bit too different, because the headline I saw this morning was how it launched to 300,000 users, I believe.
Okay, that's quite little, but yeah.
Yeah, compared to, say, Disney and a few other platforms launching, it's a bit low, but you never know. This could be something that just takes off like TikTok.
Man, TikTok, I still don't understand that thing. But hey, how's your research going into TikTok?
It stopped. I'm not doing it.
It's the future, buddy. Soon you're going to be dancing.
I don't want to be part of that future.
Even our Ministry of Education here in Malaysia has gone into TikTok.
Which is why I don't want to be part of that future.
Have you been playing with it? Because I haven't messed with it, but like the editing tools must be pretty quick. Must be pretty good for all those. Everything I see is so well edited.
So yeah, I've never used TikTok.
Yeah, no, I don't know. Yeah,
I've seen some of the videos because they pop up.
So
on
you didn't
my
do
Instagram
very much
feed.
Research.
You didn't do any research.
I didn't do any research. I refused.
But I mean, the kind of videos people put out, you got to be an expert at editing. So clearly, the stuff, the tools on the app must be pretty damn good.
I don't know. Maybe someone should try it.
Looking at you, buddy.
God damn it. I tried Snapchat. I have no idea what I'm doing. Like, I don't know how to use the app. Like, I don't know how to find...
Yeah, there's no instructions.
There's no instructions.
Yeah, Snapchat, there were certain things in there that annoyed me as, like, someone who's worked in, you know, a little bit of UI development. Yeah. There was certain things where it's like the swipes where there's like, it doesn't have even an arrow in the corner to tell you that's something to do.
Yeah.
That infuriated me on that one.
Yeah.
So, and as a result, it died, I think. Snapchat's essentially dead now. So
I think it died. I think it died also because Instagram was kind of ripping off all of their filters, right? But that being said, just side note before we get into our reviews, the Snapchat filters, which I see online, the technology, I think they're way ahead even compared to Instagram. The kind of augmented reality stuff they do is really quite interesting. There's a new one they released where it's a Malaysian one. So if you put your 10 ringgit on the table and you use their filter, the 10 ringgit will fly up and then it'll show you where it's spent with regards to COVID. Like how much your donation, where your donation is used and all of that stuff. So I was like, wow, that's pretty funky.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Pity no one's using it. All right. Let's talk reviews. We'll start off with a new series on Amazon Prime because it was released last week. It's called Tales from the Loop. Before we get into our review, I have to say, Ian, I haven't seen Bahe this enraged. I just would get random because you started watching it after we did. So I think he didn't want to spoil things. So I would just get WhatsApp messages from him going, "What the fuck? Is that it? What's going on?"
I've been
watching 40 minutes.
Yeah,
I was busy watching Vagabond over the weekend. I was like, I'm not working. I'm gonna watch it.
Because I saw the first four episodes and then I stopped.
Yeah.
And then when we were gonna do it for this podcast, I sort of think yesterday I had to barrel through the other four, and it was just infuriating.
Even though, wait, you thought the back four were infuriating, I thought the front four were infuriating.
I think they're both infuriating. Like, for me, it was just this idea that, look, it feels like, after reading your review, Ian, available now on Goggler.my, that it feels like they're building these stories out of an image. So there's nothing.
They are.
Well, they literally
are. I
know,
but my point is, it doesn't feel like they're building enough of the story. Like, nothing fucking happens. And I'm just like, the fuck is this shit?
It is interesting in an adaptation, because if you don't know about the series, it's based upon the work of Simon Stålenhag, who's a Swedish artist who does an awful lot of work that was like set in some mythical 80s where there's mechs or weird,
and those are beautiful,
you know, offshoots from some crazy tech. They are beautiful. His site is amazing. He did a couple of books as well. There was Tales in the Loop is this one. Things from the Flood. The Electric State is basically where he does the same thing with a story in the US, which has also been the rights for that have been sold to the Russo brothers.
Oh.
But there's not so much a melancholy in there, but there's more of a feeling of just like these great juxtapositions. Like I said in my article, it feels new when you're seeing it. It doesn't look like, it's like I did a recent I did a recent rewatch of Aliens for something else, and watching the alien looks like nothing else. Mm. You see a monster after that, it's like the Predator is the only thing that comes close because it's so different.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's the same with this. You haven't seen any artwork like these. The mechs don't look like mechs from anything else.
Yeah.
Everything looks this like really nice style to it. And when I was Googling for images for the article, he redid some of his images that were the basis for the show, but with the characters from the show, so it kind of fits nicer.
Nice.
But it's just melancholy. I was trying, I had to control F to figure out how many times I used melancholy in the review, because it pervades everything in it. And so many people in the show are assholes. It is the setup of Eureka or any of those shows where there is a town that is doing science shit. And weird shit happens, and apparently, whatever they manufacture in the Mercer Center for Advanced Physics or something like that, what they don't manufacture is warning tape.
Yeah. No, that was my biggest problem with the show. As I was watching it, I'm like, why have you assholes left all of this shit lying around? There are children. There are children everywhere. And there are these dangerous, sciencey things that can stop time and cause people to body swap. Yeah. And there are children. I mean, I think I only have one of his books. I have Tales from the Loop. And originally it was set in Sweden, right? Mm. This one is in Ohio, Oregon, somewhere in bumfuck America, right? But it's originally set in Sweden. And yes, beautiful pieces of artwork. But also, he kind of gives you like a paragraph to kind of describe this weird, strange setting we're in, right? And Bahe is right. They don't do enough to build a viable story around these things. For me, it is absolutely gorgeous to look at. Like, in episode 4, which is the Andrew Stanton episode, about the grandfather who is aging and dying, it is phenomenal. Like, when they shoot these empty rooms, it's like, it is, the set design is perfect. It is pristine.
Yeah.
But it's just nice to look at. For the most part... I know that episode for me was the best. I mean, Andrew Stanton's brilliant. I mean, that for me was the best episode. But I mean, on the whole, it feels like it's taking well-worn science fiction stories that we've seen and heard many, 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 many times before, and then just kind of applying it to the setting.
Yeah, the first three episodes, it feels like it's setting up an anthology show, but it's ripping off anthology shows you've already seen.
Right.
Looking at it's Nathaniel Halpern is the showrunner or creator listed as the creator, but the writer on the episode is listed in Simon Sondheim. Now, I'm not sure if that's just overall on IMDb or they have underwriters underneath each episode, but you know, the third episode, I think, is Stasis, which is basically a kind of stopwatch for the Twilight Zone. It's the same setup. And after watching the first two episodes, I was starting to write down in my notes, well, it's an episode where they stop time. And instead of just being like, you stop time and the stopwatch breaks, as in that Twilight Zone episode, the added cream on top of the sundae is that, you know, oh, it's a little bit more look at the human side of it. So it's like, you know, trying to capture that first blush of love or recapture it and make it last for longer. And it's like, I get that, but when you're just doing this generic, like the sci-fi tropes are just well worn. They're so worn out. Like there's grooves in them.
Yeah.
Then what happens in the second episode then starts to, the body swap episode starts to have impacts, but like the tone there is completely off. It's like, is this a horror? Is this supposed to be a horror? Why is everyone an asshole? Like Rebecca Hall and it was driving me nuts what I know her husband from, Paul Schneider. He's Mark Brandanowitz from Parks and Rec.
That's right.
And there's beautiful moments in there. There's a point where his body swapped neighbor's son in his body is like having some problems and he says, I don't want to talk about it. And he says to the kid, what gave you that idea? I want, why the hell do you think I want to talk about it? Like there are these individual moments that are really human and amazing. There's also the moment where he's talking about the youngest son is talking about the teachers in the school calling him by his older brother's name, which is something anyone who's gone to the same school, I've heard that from so many people in the past. I remember that from secondary school. There's these beautiful moments like that. In the final episode, there's a moment Rebecca Hall corrects his posture at the dining table as the time is progressing. Finale is directed by Jodie Foster. And it's like, that fourth episode doesn't even have the tropes in it. There's like a minor science fiction thing. I don't know whether that's just because Andrew Stanton is really good or he chose the episode he could get away with making great.
Yeah, I mean,
I would have preferred more of that or a little, like, it's just there's such a line down the middle of characters who are assholes and characters who are not, and there's just too much walking around and looking at shit.
Yeah,
but also it feels like everything was shot in slow motion. So even the episode where the lovers decide to pause time, for example, this is episode number 3, I believe.
Yeah,
their conversations could be quicker. So she says something and then there's just...
It could be a Queeby episode.
Yeah, it really could, because she says something and there is this unnatural pregnant pause before he replies. And
yeah,
it seems intentional to slow down the action because that is the kind of look and feel that we're going for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and it doesn't help as well that while they're doing that, the theme is driving us nuts because it reminded us of Blade Runner.
Yes. Well, I couldn't figure it out. And then you were like, oh, it's the end theme to Blade Runner, which is kind of slowed down. Yeah. I'm like, that's it. That's exactly it.
That's exactly it. The music does, it builds nicely. I thought those back areas, so there's one with the family dealing with grief in advance. What's the other one? The man who doesn't know what he's got till he goes to a parallel universe.
Yeah.
And the Control episode as well, which is the guy who tries to protect his family and he gets a big robot to do it, which is one of the most famous Stalingrad paintings. I kind of like those. Like, I preferred them more than the first ones because the tropes were less and it was just people dealing with stuff.
For me, that one with the robot protecting his family, that's a good one because to me, it's just nothing happens. There's no...
Mm. Well, he grows as a person, man. He's like, he's got personal growth.
It's just like, it just feels, everything in that series feels not enough, which is what was annoying for me.
Yeah.
It's just a little bit shy of being interesting or well, maybe interesting, not the word, but just a little bit shy of being exciting, being, yeah. It, like, for example, the one where the guy goes to the parallel universe. I'm just like, I just found it really annoying.
You know, for me, the contrast to this is something like Amazing Stories, which was running on Apple TV Plus, right? And when you watch Amazing Stories, it is time-tested tropes, right? There is nothing particularly new or original about those stories. They're very steeped in nostalgia, primarily catered for the kind of people who like the original series. However, that being said, that series doesn't purport to be anything else. It is completely uncynical. It is to show you that there is good in the world no matter what. It is one of those feel-good shows that you show your children growing up to get them to appreciate science fiction. That's that kind of show.
And it's an did anyone finish the recent Twilight
Zone?
Yes,
yeah.
I did, yeah.
Yeah. Did it have links through episodes, or were they just had callbacks?
They had some one or two callbacks or casual mentions, but that's about it. Right,
it was
truly an anthology show. Yeah, Twilight Zone was great. The last episode in particular was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, this can't decide if it wants to be that or something.
Yeah, that's the problem.
It feels like there is a message here, or it feels like it wants to have a message. But I think I would have preferred it if it just tried to tell human stories about people stuck in this town, as opposed to science fiction stories.
It is Art House Eureka, and Eureka did it better.
Yeah.
Tales from the Loop is now streaming on Amazon Prime. You can check it out. Let us know what you think when you do. You can get in touch with us on all of our socials, GogglerMY, including TikTok, coming soon, managed by Bayou. All right. there's a new series coming out on HBO. This one's launching later in the month, but the kind folks at HBO gave us early access to the first 5 episodes of Run. It was created by the same people behind Fleabag. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is also an executive producer on the show. And it stars Merritt Weaver and Donald Gleeson as two former lovers who decide to ditch their lives and run off together as part of a little university pact that they made
17 years earlier. Yeah.
A best friend's wedding style pact.
Kind of, I guess, right? But, you know, in the modern age, it means I will send you a text message saying run. And if you reply, then it's time to run. Bahia was kind of lukewarm on the series.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
A couple of reasons. One being that... So after watching the first 5 episodes, the series goes places that I didn't expect it to go. And I liked that I had no idea what to expect when the series started. and I have no idea where it's going before it reaches episode 8. And I think for me, it was genuinely surprising. And it's been a long time since I've seen something that is like a TV show there where the plot is so surprising. And the two of them, like Merritt Weaver, give her all the Emmys. She is like awkward and sexy and funny and weird and miserable and depressed all at the same time. It's just, her performance is incredible.
And you see it in her face, right? I think for me, when I first saw Merritt Weaver when she was playing...
Studio 60?
Yeah, in Studio 60 when she was playing... what's his name?
Matthew
Perry's assistant, yes. And I thought she was great in that, but I missed... I think I may have seen a couple episodes of Godless, which she is the lead of. And I think that's what she won her Emmy for. But she's great. She's great in this. And I think, for me, that was the one thing that I really liked about the show. The two of them are amazing together.
Donald Gleeson using his Irish accent for once.
Yeah, I know, right? For the first time. That's how he actually talks, right?
Yeah, I think that's pretty close. And I was just happy to hear the... What was the phrase he said? He was smashed off. Lovely to hear the phrase, I'm smashed off my tits on HBO.
Yes. That, and also the reference to boots.
Yeah, the boots one was great.
And she's like,
what's boots? I'd say I'm only in the second episode because you guys are covering it. I don't know where it's going to go. I am interested in seeing where it's going.
Oh, it's
going
to go places, man.
He goes places, dude.
There's a point when something happens and I was like, what the fuck now?
Really?
Yeah. And that's the part where we stopped having episodes and you just go like, shit.
So then what would you describe, having seen that more, what is the genre? Because it's set up now as a meet cube, a re-meet cube, I guess, a reunion cube.
No idea.
From the first few episodes. And as it goes on, like, is it going into
It's comedy thriller.
It's comedy thriller, adventure, road trip.
I don't know about adventure road trip, though. I won't go that far.
I think there's one episode. Train
in episode 5?
Yes.
It's on and off the train. So like the train is the primary kind of thing. Venue, right? It's the primary set.
I always like movies where they do like they give themselves restrictions in order to
So I think in episode 3 or 4, or maybe even in 5, you find out why they're on the train. You find out what the queue run is. It's not just to bolt. It's a let's see what happens kind of situation. So they've set themselves a timeline even in this pack that they've built. So it's curious to see if they will end it there at the end of the season or if they're going to go on, because
there's a hint of that in the first episode where it's like we have a certain train, but we won't talk about certain things for a certain amount of time.
It's a
moratorium.
Really well thought out plan, right? It's not just run. It's run, I'll see you at this station on the first train after 5 o'clock. And you just go, ooh, that's how you make a plan for 17 years later.
Is the guy is the guy on her phone as big an asshole as he sounds? Or does he crop up more?
No.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is what I like about the show, or at least I like about the concept of the show, right? Because I think all of us have, you know, when I was first watching the show, I was thinking, oh, I'm sure this will appeal to a certain demographic of people who just want to escape their lives. And then I thought about it some more and I was like, no, actually, all of us have aspects of our lives that we just want to escape. Mm. But how many of us are willing to say, fuck you to everything and just go, right?
Yeah.
And it asks and answers a lot of those questions about, are you the good guy? Are you the bad guy? Is your happiness worth forsaking an entire life and everyone else's happiness? And all of these things. But it answers it not in a stupid expository way. It actually does it slowly using story and action. And like when you find out certain reveals about her life and about his life, it doesn't feel like they've just held it back for the sake of it. Mm. It feels like a natural point in which this would come up in an argument or a fight. Like, I mean, this isn't much of a spoiler, but in the second episode, I think you might have seen this bit already. They go into the train and they're going to have sex for the first time. And she pulls down her pants and he sees a scar and he realizes she has children. And
he's already seen the phone.
He's seen the phone, but it kind of hits him home in the heat of the moment, right? And I think like those, but it's not... it's not meant, it's not spelt out.
Yeah. And he doesn't bring it up either. No. It's just like, it's there for you to figure it out.
Correct. And I think all of that's just really, really tight writing. Yeah. When you get to episode 5, I think, yeah, you might text us when you have that WTF moment.
Like, for me, my thing is that I in the sense that we are lucky in that we are able to binge 5 episodes. I don't think this is something I'll go back to 7 days later to watch. Like, say, Westworld, Game of Thrones. You know, it's not something that makes me go, okay, it's Monday, I need to shut down to watch this show. It's not appointment television, which to me, it was the surprising thing for HBO, I think, because a lot of their stuff is essentially written as that, right? It's appointment TV. Chernobyl was appointment TV. Stop talking to me, Chernobyl's on. Whereas this doesn't quite feel like that for me. Yeah.
It is very bingeable.
It is very bingeable.
It's 20, 22 minute really bites, and you can just keep going. Just
go,
No, I was liking the style and liking the movement of it. So
the first 5 minutes, just it shoots out of a gun. There's no messing about. There's no, you know, you don't spend time with her in her home life. You don't show she's bored. Nothing. It just out of the gates, which is a great opener.
So Run premieres on HBO on Monday. Check it out. Let us know what you think when you do. Our next review is of a local film. This one's called Daulat. It is written and directed by Imran Sheikh. It stars Tony Yusuf and Vanita Imran, among others. It was originally, I guess, made for cinemas, but because our Malaysian censorship board would have too much to say about that, they decided to launch it on streaming services instead.
Well, they did actually have, I did some search, they did submit and they were told that they had to make considerable changes. It's part of the advertising they said for their watch on iFlix is that it's uncut with the swearing and everything in there, which I didn't realize because it's, I don't know, something about watching on your TV at home. It's not so shocking when you see like people swear. It's like, oh, okay.
Well, I mean, there are two things, right? I mean, if it was in cinemas, you wouldn't see local people swearing as much. You would also not see Malay people drinking alcohol.
Hey, it's just syrup, man.
Iced tea, man. Iced tea.
Yeah, he likes the bottle. To decant them.
But Daulat actually is streaming for free on iFlix, so you can actually check it out even if you don't have an iFlix account or subscription. But it was an interesting decision to actually put it on there, especially now, given that cinemas are closed. I think, you know, Ian, you mentioned in your review something very, very true. We won't know what the cinema audience will be like for this movie. But a lot of people, from what I've seen on social media, are watching it because it's so easily accessible on their screens at the moment. So in that way, it's a very good thing. But the sad thing is we'll never know if this thing would have been successful on screen in cinemas when people had to leave their house and actually pay to go watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so before we get into the review, of just a very quick summary. The movie is essentially about the events following a general election, ours, pretty much. It doesn't take a genius to figure that out. Where we take a look into the losing side. So essentially, imagine going into the mind of Najib and his cronies after the election as they plot to retake the country in 5 years at the next general election. That's essentially it, a view from the other side. Right.
Yeah. And they do set out that plan straight away. They set out, this is the 3-pronged plan we're going to do.
Correct.
And then it moves from there. And they kind of don't follow that plan. I mean, they follow the plan, but you're not clear that's the plan when you're watching.
Yes. The interesting thing about the film is that I'd say it's politically neutral in the sense that it whacks both sides in equal measure. Mm. It kind of portrays politicians as a whole, as being in it for themselves, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's got one of the worst taglines I've ever heard, which is, you cannot win in politics by being nice. Like, it's the nice, they should have found a different word for nice. It says weird.
But see, unlike M for Malaysia or what was the name? Oh, Rise Ini Khalila, where...
Yeah, I was trying to remember that.
Where politicians are kind of... There's a group of politicians that are painted as kind of saviors, right? In this case...
Also, based on those three movies, if you're thinking of doing anything on politics in Malaysia, wait 6 months to a year because...
Who knows what will happen?
It's going to change, bro.
It paints at least one side as being saviors or one side as being heroic. And this side kind of shows that one side is ineffectual and the other side is evil. I mean, it's very, very House of Cards. And when I say House of Cards, I mean very House of Cards, because the entire plot of the movie kind of runs in parallel with the first season of House of Cards.
It's got the characters from House of Cards. It's got all the different beats from House of Cards. And
I miss House of Cards. I was watching anime, so I missed that. But I was wondering about that.
Right down to the kind of journalist, media, plot, planting false stories.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's very... Yeah. The parallels run very, very true, if you will. But, you know, like I said, there's nothing wrong with cribbing from House of Cards. I mean, they are the best. They are the standard.
If you got to steal safe from the best. Yeah,
exactly. But you got to make sure you get it right. And this is where it kind of fell short for me, because for me, there was far too much. Like, I watch a lot of political thrillers or political shows, everything from The West Wing to movies like Primary Colors or Wag the Dog and Bullworth, for example. The problem with Dawlat for me is that there is too much exposition. Everything is kind of, you know, take The West Wing, for example. It deals with very high concept political issues that are, that many people outside of the US would be completely unawares of. But the way, and it realizes it needs to explain that to the mass audience. But the way it explains it is through action, conflict, and conversation. So whether there is a noob in the room, which is like, oh, what's that about? And someone explains the policy, or whether it's a series of actions involving the characters in which this policy becomes apparent. Here it's a PowerPoint presentation. And at that point, I kind of just slapped my... I really didn't like
that median voter description at all,
well,
did you?
Okay. So Bahe didn't feel this way about what happened after that scene, but I felt like, with all of the exposition and lecturing that goes on up till that point, and then immediately when she does it, the politician in the room, this UMNO stand-in, goes, I don't understand what you're saying, but I agree.
But I agree.
For me, it felt like unintentional arrogance on the part of the writers. It's like, you know, and I was just like, I know you're trying to say that the UMNO politician is stupid. I know that's what you're saying. But at the same time, it feels like you mean... that about all of us.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're saying. I didn't see it that way at all.
Yeah. For me, it just felt like a character thing. And for me, I kept telling you guys this. I must have repeated it to you guys maybe 3-4 times now, but it feels like a TV show. It feels like he just took House of Cards, took all the A plots and made it into a film and leaving out all the B plots, because I was talking about it with my wife and we don't know who we're supposed to empathize with. We don't know whose point of view we're supposed to be watching this from. We don't know. And when I use the word hero, I don't mean the good guy, but I mean, who is the person that, who's the antagonist? Who's the protagonist? We don't know any of these things. It's just a muddle of characters. There's a daughter character that is only there so that something can happen later on, which then proves...
Her defining characteristic is that she cannot read contracts.
They say it in the script.
No, but the thing is, she didn't need to. They told her in her face what the problem, what the deal was, and you're going to be on the hook for this. So it wasn't that, I know you grabbed on that, but that wasn't a problem. Her defining thing is that she's worried and she needs to get $6 million. That's literally it.
And a lot of it
is just really pedestrian writing. That bit about her needing $6 million. She goes, let me think. I have $2 million. So I need to find...
A train leaves Chicago at 6 p.m. and I've got 16 apples.
It's just like, don't need to work out... The math, it's not science here. It just feels very pedestrian writing. And that was a lot of the problem.
But when you talk about House of Cards, you're talking about the American version, right?
Yes. Not the British version. Yeah. The American version, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But in the American version, it was
a lot more cynical... I mean, the British version was pretty cynical, but the American version takes it to the extreme of
Kevin Spacey.
Well, it's like it's Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright together. Like, they're the main characters in that show, right?
Which is very similar to Idris and Suri. Their marriage and their relationship.
It's not really clear straight off the bat that if they were the actual protagonists, we had more of that conversation. There's some stuff that happens that, like, I mentioned in my review, there's the scene that plays as horror.
Yes.
It's the yeehaw! Yep. It's the yeehaw! Oh shit! Moment, but it plays as hard because the music. I thought the music was. I mean, Imran Sheik is a first-time director, as far as I understand. Do you know who this guy is?
He did Jibril. He did Jibril for View.
Ah, I mean, the film looks good. The music, I thought, again, was really, really good. But this moment, it plays like a horror, and you're thinking, is this Fatal... What was it called? Basic Instinct?
Fatal Attraction? Basic Instinct?
The one with Glenn... Fatal Attraction. Yeah. Is this Fatal Attraction? I'm like, it feels like Fatal Attraction at this point. Is this where we're going? And then it pulls back from that completely. We get these other characters doing other stuff. And then, like I said, there's a moment where we were ahead of you, Uma, and it just... It just skateboards over the shark completely with like a fireworks show going off in the background. It's like, what? The tone goes completely out the window. And that was the writing and stuff of that. I'm watching subtitles, so I'm missing a lot of the stuff. I saw people when I was live, I was just jokingly posting childish bullshit online as I do. And people were saying like, oh, this is the worst line in the movie. And it's like, it doesn't come across that way to me because I'm not hearing it in the traditional Klingon.
Right.
I'm only getting it in the English subtitles where, you know, you've already pared down and you're already in that mode of just taking the information in. So it wasn't so much, I didn't have that much of a problem with that. Weird tonally things happening. It was more just like, we now need all these things to happen as if they were part of the plan. And there is no way you could figure this shit out. It was going to be fine. And if it requires, I'm a gentleman. I have a gentleman's agreement, which is not a gentleman's agreement because it's a contract, which is a legal agreement, but never mind. I'm going to go from a 3-piece suit, gentleman, to a 2-piece suit, t-shirt underneath, chain, gangster gentleman, who's still only threatening legal action. But he's talking about it like he's going to break your legs and set your house on fire.
But he's like, I'm going to get my lawyers on it.
Yeah, it's like, are your lawyer? Do you not know that? Do you think lawyers are
is thugs? That code what? For thugs? Yeah,
what's going on here?
Yeah, because no, it's not.
Yeah, it's like. I'll see you in court. Is that is he saying?
Are we talking about the food court?
Yeah. And yeah, so for all that to fall in place was just like, it's why is this happening? Because the movie's nearly over.
Yeah, there was a lot of Deus Ex Machina, right? A lot of stuff where it just happens and you know why that's happening. And you're like, yes, this is going to be used to tie in the plot later. I mean, Ian and I both mentioned our review. We've got two reviews up on Goggler MY. We've got two different takes on it. But Ian and I both mentioned that in Malaysia...
Mine's got subtitles.
Yeah, it's got subtitles, yeah. Even in Malaysia, to make a political thriller and to keep it... And to have something so skewed to reality is a brave thing on the part of everyone involved. Yeah. Even for the actors to sign on, a lot of the actors don't do this kind of work because they know it might affect their rice bowl later. So...
Yeah.
That act is a brave and a bold one. I just feel that it doesn't live up to the ambition it set for itself, which is House of Cards.
I mean, for me, I kind of disagree because the House of Cards bit is fine. They just need to pare it down a little bit, right? There are a lot of characters that are unnecessary, but they were there because it feels like they were there in House of Cards. So he must have it in this version. It just feels...
Yeah, because the guy runs the media company. He doesn't need to sleep with anyone to plan stories. He can just say, write the story.
Oh, no,
that's exactly what I was thinking throughout. Because I'm like, you own the joint.
The journalist is a character in House of Cards Season 1. She doesn't quite turn out that way, but, you know.
Does she get sexier every 3 scenes?
No.
No.
What was her name?
No, because it's a weird thing. At the beginning, she's like wearing jeans and has her hair in a ponytail. And as the show goes on, she goes like every... It's one of the few indications the time has passed.
But because
her hair
gets
more and more slick.
She's the what was the position she was going for?
Oh, she's the new general manager.
General manager.
She's the new general manager. So she
gotta dress
can't
the
wear
part.
Jeans anymore, man. Yeah, man.
I've never met a general manager like that.
Who's been in the company only 6 months? No, she's not sleeping with the boss.
But I think they didn't focus on the strength, which is the characters of the again. When I say this, it's air quotes on everything. The Wawasan government, the elder statesman Malik and his
deputy,
his enemy deputy Anwar Ali, who's basically you know wants to be prime minister next. Like they could have focused more on that and brought those more in because I think. Especially seeing as what's happened.
Well,
that kind of stuff is more...
In his defense, this movie was shot in 2019. So,
yeah.
But...
I know. That's part of my review. Is like, he could...
No way he would have known that. Yeah.
But maybe he got something unintentionally correct. Because when we see the head of the Wawasan government, he feels... He's always staring into space... And he looks like an ineffectual old man, right? I mean, we always used to give Mahathir a lot of credit as being the most cunning politician in the country. But maybe he's just old, right? I mean, as we've seen how events have played out. And I think that was an unintentional accuracy, possibly. But I think the other thing that Bahe and I were talking about after we watched the film, which we were quite annoyed about, there's a scene when Ali, the deputy, is at a women's march and he's walking in front of an LGBT flag. And I'm just like, well, that's unnecessary unless you've actually set it up to be something to take him down.
Well, they kind of did later on. They had like there were statements about he's pro-LGBT.
But that's what I mean. That was part of it. It came like later on.
It just feels accidental.
Yeah.
I was about to take a screenshot around that time when it was like, oh, I can see my house in here. Where's that bomb?
Yeah.
I think I don't think that was accidental. I think that was on purpose. I felt that was on purpose because they had to set that up in order to like he was a clown because he went to that meeting without thinking about it and he didn't look in his rearview mirror to see what was behind him. But also they were taking wishy-washy responses. They were not being the thesis of the movie was they were not being effective. They were responding instead of they were reacting instead of acting.
Correct. Yeah. But all of that happens after as a kind of exposition. And I think it would have been interesting because we see Jasmine's character interview him and we think it's part of a setup.
Mm.
But
oh, it is. Everything's the same.
Yeah, but at the same time, you don't need Frank Underwood to wink at the camera. Mm. You know what is the setup. Like when you're watching House of Cards, you feel for the sap who's taken in by Frank Underwood because you know two episodes later, all your money is going to go, your wife's going to be dead, and you're going to be out on the streets. You know, that's what happens. And you feel for that sap, right? And you know something's going to happen to him. Because it's written so intricately in that way. It doesn't happen here.
No. And instead, you get one of the most damning things, which is the end of it, which is where a character, like, at first, it's just like they look directly at the camera as if, see? And then the credits roll. I thought, like, okay, that's a weird choice. Yeah. But then they come back.
Then they come back.
And start explaining the movie.
Yeah. Yes. Basically, that was why I said unintentional arrogance, right? Because it was that bit at the end as well, following the PowerPoint presentation, where one of the characters decides to take a moment, break the fourth wall, and do Frank Underwood, but only not in a Frank Underwood way, rather in a lecturing way, telling you what this movie is about. In case you missed it, good governance is very important.
They have to sneak in the moral values at the end, somehow.
Yeah, I think it would have been better if that was like, you know, draw your own conclusions, to quote Guinness ads. Like, it should have been left to, like, you know, give your audience enough wherewithal to do it themselves. So it's like, being nice is going to get you killed, motherfucker.
You can't win in politics by being nice, Ian.
Such a bad line.
That being said, I have to say, the movie does reinforce the notion that Tony Yusuf is a sexy son of a bitch.
Those suits look good.
Yeah, I was watching the whole movie and I was thinking, why don't we have politicians that look like that? He is Dr. Smolder Bravestone. That is what he is. I'm watching it and I'm just like, goddamn, man.
Yeah. I watch the credits these days. First of all, the music I thought was really good. And when I looked at it, it wasn't one band or composer. It seemed to be all sorts.
Oh, okay.
Which was interesting because it worked together. But yeah, there was a specific... It was like Mr. Tony Yusuf's wardrobe was provided by one company.
Nice. Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. He wears that suit well.
He does.
I mean, like, there were a bunch of parts in the movie, man, where I was just head slapping. I mean, like, face palming all the way. You know, it was the PowerPoint presentation, but then it was the Machiavelli bit, which I talk about in my review, and I just couldn't. I just really couldn't. It's like at a pivotal moment you kneel before the poster
that
of Machiavelli.
Really felt out of place. It just felt unnecessarily out of place. It felt like this guy going, hey man, I read the book. I didn't know who it was exactly. It was only until Uma mentioned it was Mark, and then it sort of comes back going, and no, but that's the problem, right? It feels like he's saying, hey, I know Machiavelli. You don't know who that is, but I know who that is. See, she's kneeling on the,
she's read The Prince.
She's read it, yeah.
In one of the character posters for Daulat, she's mirroring that in her look. She's wearing a red tudong.
That's not her, isn't it? I thought that was Jasmine, wasn't it?
No, it was her. It was Suri. Yeah.
It was Suri, yeah.
Because she doesn't dress like that at all in the movie.
No.
I think it was those in-your-face moments, which are really on the nose, that I felt were unnecessary. Like, you could have taken it out of the movie, and it would have been just fine.
And I think it would be, that's what I was thinking about. Like, it would be, like I said, I know filmmakers who have set their... their local dramas in the Republic of Kriplakistan,
which oh, yes.
has a weird mix yeah. of different languages and Malay in order to get around this stuff. To have it actually say it's Malaysia and it's Muna, not Umno, and it's Wawasan, not Bersatu. Like that I like that a lot, and I think they could have embraced it more. I mean, if they wanted to, if they'd known how things have gone, they probably would have changed the characters a yeah. bit, then they wouldn't be able to rip off House of Cards so much, I guess. But I should also say, I was just like, I'm really enjoying these Dane Side
cameos?
Appearances in
yes.
movies. Cameos. like, it wasn't really he was the bad guy in Weira, and I thought he was like a Malaysian Alan Rickman in that. It was fantastic.
Yeah. What's funny about this particular cameo, so Dane plays a political pundit on a TV show, on a news show, talking about what happened and how, you know, the other side, how Muna comes back into power following an election. It is pretty
much... G15, not based in Malaysia. Not based in Malaysia, G15. Not based
G15, Malaysia. G15. But...
That title card, we repeat. Like, they say it twice. This is purely fictional, not based on any particular people. We repeat. Yeah. It's not based on Malaysia. It's like...
That'll do the trick.
He thinks the lady doth protest too much.
Yeah, because I'm like, dude, if they want to get you for sedition, that title card ain't going to help. But when you watch that Dane Side bit, it's hilarious because it is a conversation you would have with actual Dane Side. He didn't have to do anything. Because I swear, I've heard Dane say, I hate their guts, but...
Yeah.
You can't deny that they're very cunning. Written.
That was all Dane Side, just off the cuff, probably.
Yeah. That being said, there was one cut, which you pointed out, Ian. One very obvious cut.
It's weird. Well, first of all, I mean, we should say a little bit. Our review took a while because there's no English subtitles for me to look at for the first day or two, which is weird. Don't do that ever again. If you're launching something, fucking launch it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like Disney Plus launching with no audio on Moana.
That would be a travesty. But Ian started watching this and then he said, hey, at about 11-minute mark, there's a weird disconnect between the audio and the subtitles. So we went to see and Idris...
The audio cuts out.
Yeah, and Idris is talking about streaming services and he gives examples and he says, like Netflix and it cuts out. Yeah. But the subtitles read like Netflix and iFlix.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
His mouth looks like he's saying View.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't look into the flaps that much. I was like trying to get through the rest of the movie. But you reckon it's his
View?
Jibril was on View,
yes,
right?
That's what I was going to say. Jibril was a View exclusive.
And are they a production company or a restaurant or both?
I think now they're a production company.
No.
Were they a restaurant to start with? Because they're a restaurant in this that serves the best butter chicken. In the movie, they go to a restaurant called Jibril. That's what they're hanging out the whole time.
But I'd like to try that butter chicken.
In a bar, apparently. It's just weird. Yeah.
So... I think...
Was this at some point supposed to... I did see, when I was looking for images online, I saw a picture of the guy who played Idris with a View logo on it, and I'm not sure whether it was originally supposed to be on View, maybe?
So for me, I suspect it was. I think because he made Jibril, which is a 7-8 episode series for View, and I think maybe he was pitching this for View, and then maybe View saw the script and freaked out.
Then they wouldn't have recorded it. So I think they must have made it already, right?
Yeah.
And then do you think it might have been a series originally? Because it's the kind of thing that could possibly have worked as an 8-episode series, right?
Oh, no, absolutely.
And if it was an 8-episode series, maybe they would have developed these characters more rather than just be doppelgangers and stand-ins.
I think some of the big stuff that's come out, like they've interviewed, a couple of media guys have interviewed the director, and he said that, well, they only shot it in 2 weeks, so I think it was always to be a feature.
What?
They shot it in 2 weeks.
They shot it in 2 weeks?
15 days or something. So I think it's always been a feature, but, you know, yeah.
Doesn't look like it was shot in 2 weeks. That's pretty slick.
No, no.
Yeah, the production
really
value is pretty good.
Really good, yeah.
Daulat, you can check out both of our reviews on Goggler MY. Daulat is streaming now on iFlix for free, so be sure to go check it out. Malaysia's first political thriller. And let us know if you think it lives up to the hype, if you think it achieves and delivers on what it sets out to do. So now it's time as always for recommendations. But hey, do you have any recommendations for people?
So... I'm running out of comics to read because my comic store's closed. But I checked out the Marvel app, and there's quite...
Because they were giving away free stuff?
There's a lot of free stuff on there. So I read a press release that said that they were going to keep refreshing the line or refreshing the comics that are available. So my recommendation is, if you've got nothing else to do, I say check out the Marvel app. It works here. You don't even need to log. You don't even need to sign up. So when you download the app on your phone, there are two buttons. One that says sign up, login. The other one says free comics. Just click free comics. You can read a whole bunch. There's a lot of, I think all of the Civil Wars are there. Ta-Nehisi Coates, Black Panther's on there. So there's a lot of really good stuff.
That's actually really good. That's actually really good,
I heard. Yeah,
I bought those.
I'm currently reading Ta-Nehisi Coates' run on Captain America, and that's very good. That's not on there. But there's a lot of, you know, relatively new stuff there. 2018, 2019 contents on there. So that's my recommendation.
On a relative note, I think Comixology's Unlimited app is... They've upped their trial from 30 days to 60 days.
Oh.
Oh, nice.
So I've been hovering over signing up for that for 60 days.
59 days.
Nice.
Oh, sweet. All right. Yeah. So my recommendation is the Marvel. It's called Marvel Unlimited. So check out the app.
All right. Ian, what you got? Oh, wait. You've got the cats video.
Well, yeah. So I'm halfway through it. I do like Lindsay Ellis' stuff. It's very funny. It's just... the editing, it's just these video essays online. Patrick A. Williams has another one up in his series of Patrick Explains Stuff, where he's trapped in his parents' house that he has actually, he's conscripted his parents into his videos, and they're very, very funny if you've seen them.
Nice.
Like there's a through line, there's a plot line going on, and like this latest episode is on Labyrinth, and it's the plot line is he's trapped with his parents and his flatmates have access to all his equipment, and they're going to do stuff on Labyrinth, Reaganism, and capitalism.
Nice.
And that's pretty good, but the Lindsay Ellis one is about 40 minutes long, so that's one I have to set aside more time for. But yeah,
cool.
I'm just going to rotate between Lindsay Ellis, Mikey Newman, and Patrick H. Williams every week. They're that good. Actually, Patrick, I don't think I mentioned it, he did one on The Mask of Zorro.
As in the Antonio Banderas movie?
Oh. Yes.
Oh, yes. And just,
it reminded me how good that movie is, and I need to catch a copy of it. Things like he pointed out how...
That's on Netflix, by the way.
Is it on Netflix?
It popped up on my feed the other day.
Every explosion in that movie, they have like animal sounds in the background. Like it goes, which is just like, what? I knew at the time it was something that was in the back of my head. But when you pointed it out to me, it was like, that is ludicrous and genius. And also he points out like, you know, you can talk about this. You can talk about like the Hulk and Iron Man fighting and all this kind of stuff. But there's just something about a man in a cape fighting two guys with swords and then doing a backflip or a front flip out of the scene that just... You know, there's that groundedness to the whole thing. And looking at the clips they put in the film, in the video, it looks like it holds up really well.
And Catherine Zeta-Jones walking in slow motion, baby.
That's that. I think there's a whole segment of that movie, of that video just called, "This Movie is Horny as Fuck." It might be the horniest. I think it's the horniest action movie of all time.
It's peak Catherine Zeta-Jones. It's what it was.
And peak, and
peak Antonio Banderas, too.
I want to insert the Antonio Banderas leaning back perfection gif into this conversation, because it is like they have a fight scene with swords in the stables where they're slowly cutting away each other's clothes, real sexy like.
That's right. I forgot about that. Oh my god.
Yeah. So that's on Netflix. I'm gonna watch. I'm sorry, Vagabond's gonna have to wait. I'm gonna watch that.
All right. My recommendation is something that just dropped. The Good Fight is back, baby. The Good Fight Season 4. It's actually streaming on Astro as well. I think it'll be streaming like a day after it gets released in the US. But it dropped in the US yesterday. This, I have been trying to preach to everyone who would listen that they need to watch this show. The problem with The Good Fight is that it is impossible to describe what this show is, right? Like, The Good Wife was kind of easy. The Good Wife was Alicia Florrick, who has to go back to work and provide for her family after her husband gets thrown in jail after a sex and corruption scandal. Now, the show got really complex over like 156 episodes, but...
The NSA plotline got real weird.
Real weird, but the basic core was always Alicia's struggle, right? And it was always that conflict with her husband that was always there. The Good Fight, man, this show goes places and it's so good. This first episode...
It's still weekly, right?
Yeah, it's still weekly. And the first episode of this season 4 gets even better because she wakes up and she's in a world where Hillary Clinton has won.
She was microdosing on acid last season.
What? Exactly. See what I mean? And it's a great episode because it kind of goes places where Oh, it's so smart. Because Hillary's won and Weinstein was a big supporter, Me Too never happened. Right? Ooh, and oh, it is so smart the way this show is written, right? And it's this constant battle between, I guess, the liberal agenda and how you achieve your means without becoming like Donald Trump or his cronies, right? And it's really well written. It's not cynical. It's kind of realistic. And that was the same with The Good Wife.
Yeah, there's a lot of, there can be downbeats, but I think she'll generally rally and come around to, you know, I need to do my part.
Yeah.
Because I think that was, this is the, which, four? Season four?
Season four.
Yeah, I think it was season two where there was like, there was quite a, two or three, there was quite a long period where she was just completely down the dumps and Maya had a shitty fucking job.
Yeah.
And I didn't like, Michael Sheen's character was too big for the show, I think.
Oh, really? I loved his character.
Yeah,
I
kind of thought he destabilized it quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, he was the very epitome of corruption. It was great.
Yeah, but so it's CBS All Access, so it's weekly again,
yeah,
right? And then it's...
It's CBS All Access in the US. It's, you can catch it on demand on Astro over here. It's weekly, which means you have time to catch up with the old seasons, even if you don't, because it's only 10 episodes a season, so it's not too much to watch. But it's... I was going to say it's one of the best things on TV, but I think it's also one of the most important things on TV because it kind of really shows you how to deal with the world as it is. Not just if you're an American, but actually everywhere, because everyone seems to be facing the same problems, right? And it's this, like, that's why I said realistic and not cynical, because it's a very practical show. It kind of, there's a fantastic episode on young feminists fighting Christine Baranski because they think she's out of touch when she is the proto original feminist, right? And they think, you know, your day is done, lady. But it's the way it handles that is really smart. It's a good show. Yeah. So The Good Fight season four, you can watch on Astro. And if you're listening to this from the US, CBS All Access, let us know what you think about all the stuff we've spoken about today. Have you seen Dowlat? You can check out our reviews on goggler.my. You can check out all of our socials, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, Goggler MY. Check it out. Bahe does a dance later today. Definitely worth watching.
As he...
with his cats.
As Bahe slowly picks up his phone to try and look up TikTok.
All right. This is yet another episode of the Goggler Podcast. Signing out.